10. Analyzing an awakening experience. I showed how Douglas Harding's first-person experiments can potentially illuminate Zen accounts of awakening and vice versa. This experience can also be investigated in its own right, independently of any religious tradition. Given that the experience involves a seeing that 1. I am empty or void, and 2. I am totally unified with the given scene, it clearly fits within the category of awakening experience, as I have used the term. Certainly, many will not agree that the experiments uncover one's essential nature, and hence that they represent a genuine form of awakening. For the purposes of discussion, however, we can just focus on the phenomenology itself. The key to the current awakening experience is attention. It is turning your attention 180 degrees from the objects before you to who or what seems to be seeing them. It is not just attending to where I find a vast emptiness, but also attending outwards at its filling and seeing that they are one. Douglas Harding refers to this practice as two-way attention. It is a form of diffuse attention, in contrast to our usual outward, object-focused attention. It should be emphasized that this is not a peak or mystical experience, though it could precipitate such an experience for some, but rather a simple, perception-like experience that I am nothing for myself where I am looking from. We can distinguish, then, two types of awakening experiences. 1. Mystical peak experiences, and 2. Valley experiences. Mystical experiences, as documented by Evelyn Underhill and F.C. Happold, are rare, ecstatic experiences which commonly involve feeling a union with God or the cosmos. They are associated with extended religious practice and also the ingestion of psychedelic drugs. A valley awakening experience, however, is plain, simple, and ordinary. This experience is also voluntary and repeatable in that it is precipitated by a shift in one's attentional focus, while mystical experiences are usually unbidden and unrepeatable. One response to the experiments is, I don't get it. As a perception-like experience, there is nothing to understand. It is as basic and unexplainable as seeing the blue expanse of the sky. It should be emphasized, though, that attending to what you are apparently looking out of is a form of meditation, and hence may not transform one's experience immediately. It needs to be practiced. In my experience, this results in a transformation of one's perceptual experience. It can be likened to a gestalt shift. An example of a gestalt shift is the Necker cube. In this perceptual illusion, which square is perceived as its front side switches depending upon where one attends. In the headless experience, rather than looking out of a head, the experience shifts to me seeming to be looking out of an unbounded, open space. Rather than being a thing moving about in the world is in me. I am motionless and the landscape and objects move in my consciousness. I still feel my head and bodily sensations, but I am not confined by them. Rather, these are also in my consciousness. My thoughts and emotions are not in a head box, but in the same field as the scene. Things are seen much as before, but attention is broadened to include the field of consciousness itself. Other experiential shifts are also distinguishable. Attending inwards, the distinction between the gap and the scene is emphasized. However, Rather than just nothing, this unbounded opening seems to be awake to itself and the world. It could be described as a luminous emptiness, or pure awareness, that is nevertheless full of the seen. In Chan, pure awareness is called qi. Shen Hui stated that the one word qi is the gateway to all mysteries. The Chan master and historian Sung Mi was prominent in interpreting Shen Hui's use of qi as denoting awareness, and holding that recognizing one's true nature as ever-present awareness and empty, tranquil awareness is the essence of awakening. In another experiential mode, when attending both inwards and outwards simultaneously, two-way attention, the total unity between the space and the scene is emphasized, such that I seem to be that very scene. It could be expected that the more outwards focused this diffused attention, the more that one will be absorbed into the scene. Analogous to the Necker cube, these are different modes of an indivisible unity. The Necker cube remains a single, unified figure throughout the switching between its aspects. This analysis suggests at least three possible modes of consciousness. 1. Ordinary, everyday consciousness of being a thing in the world. 2. Being an aware no-thing full of the given world. And 3. Being the given world. Like the Necker cube, which mode is experienced depends upon one's attentional orientation. Also, none of these experiences are separable. The world is there, just as before. Here then is a way of understanding the Buddhist doctrine that delusion and awakening are identical, yet somehow different. Awakening is not like waking from a dream, but rather a change in one's perspective. One's true nature was implicitly present the entire time under one's very nose, or more precisely, behind one's nose blurs. This reminds one of Wittgenstein's famous statement, "The aspects of things that are most important for us are hidden because of their simplicity and familiarity." One is unable to notice something because it is always before one's eyes. If the experience is so simple and obvious, why don't more people spontaneously have it? Assuming that this is a genuine awakening, what are the sources of the delusion? Douglas Harding identifies at least four reasons why we don't normally notice our first-person perspective. The first reason is cognitive. We suffer from false beliefs. Douglas Harding provides a novel definition of the delusion from which we ordinarily suffer. "I am here for myself, what I look like to others over there." We are taught since early childhood to identify with how we look to others, such as in photographs and how we look to ourselves in the mirror from a few feet away. This is a category error, because it confuses what I am at zero distance for myself with how I appear from a distance. The second reason is imagination. The closed eye experiment showed that bodily sensations are less detailed and more dynamic than I usually notice, not to mention shapeless. It seems then that I learn to map how I look to others onto these sensations, and so thing myself. I hallucinate a head here, blocking up the center of my phenomenal world. This visual imagery combined with tactile imagery, how I feel to myself and others through touch, give the sense that my phenomenal body is presented as a static, all at once shaped object. This creates the illusion that I am separate from the perceived world, in a body, rather than at large as the scene, which includes my thoughts, feelings, body, and the world. Thirdly, we have an attentional bias to only attend outwards, never inwards at the looker. The result is that we overlook half of the view. As an example, we rarely notice that, phenomenologically speaking, an entire wall is missing whenever we are in a room. We fill in four closed walls in imagination, and so this vast, unbounded gap goes totally unnoticed. Harding makes the point that even a jail cell cannot confine me, because for myself, it is in my awareness. Fourthly, language systematically covers up my first-person experience by describing everyday situations from the third-person perspective. A prominent example is that we meet face-to-face. Phenomenologically speaking, I can only see others' faces because my face is totally absent. The lived experience is that we are face to no face. I am replaced by others. Another example, as discussed above, is the confusion between the first person and third person senses of see. The third person sense is a causal, functional process involving things, eyes, and brains, while the first-person sense is the phenomenal experience of seeing which is phenomenally eyeless. A final example is the way we talk about thoughts and images as being in the head, as if there was a box here that kept them separate from the perceived world. I say that the song is stuck in my head, whereas it would be more phenomenologically accurate to say that the song is stuck in my world.